Welcome to another episode of Steve's Speed Shop in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. What is Steve's Speed Shop? Well, it's been described as a digital man cave for passionate petrol heads by me, and is no place, I should warn you, for the casually interested. So, unless you've got Castrol R coursing through your veins, then perhaps you should listen elsewhere for your entertainment requirements. Have they gone? Good, we can crack on. I've been driving, well, I'll tell you what, let's see if you can guess what I've been driving from these clues. It recently, this car recorded an 8 minute and 14 second lap of Germany's legendary Nürburgring circuit, and that means it's faster than an R32 Nissan Skyline, it's faster than a Lotus Exige S, it's faster even than that icon of performance road cars, the original Honda NSX, and yet it can take four people and a load of luggage in Maybach levels of climate-controlled comfort, and once its electronically deployable tow bar is in the on position, it could tow a fully laden horse box across a ploughed field. I think you might have guessed, yes, that's right. It's the 542 brake horsepower Range Rover Sport SVR. A car that can reach its electronically limited top speed of 162 miles per hour in three of the eight forward speeds that are available to the owner driver. I have been tooling round in one, and it is a hoot and a half. But is it equal or better than the mighty Porsche Cayenne Turbo and the utterly bonkers Mercedes G63 AMG? Well, you'll have to stick around and find out if the Range Rover Sport SVR is rated or hated. But first, this. Now that is the sound of two very different, utterly remarkable and totally unique motorcycles built by the same man. His name is Alan Milliard, and I've been after an interview with this guy for ages. Now, a lot of people think that the origin of the custom motorcycle is the United States of America, and there's a good reason why they think that. There's the movie Easy Rider, there's 40 years of chopper culture, and a whole slew of reality TV shows where large men with strange hair and lots of tattoos get annoyed with each other and throw chairs across the workshop. Alan Milliard is the antithesis of that kind of bike builder, and has much more in common with the guys who were building custom bikes in the United Kingdom a good decade before Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper went looking for America in the movie Easy Rider on their chopped Harley Davidson. Back in the 50s in the UK, young men were building bikes in their back bedrooms, in garden sheds and in garages. Because there were no custom shops, there were no speed shops, you had to do it yourself. These bikes were based on the new breed of high-performance motorcycle for the likes of Triumph, Norton and BSA. The press dubbed them a danger, rockers, tunnock boys, sawdust Caesars and coffee bar cowboys. Alan built bikes in his shed, but he builds remarkable motorcycles. He's been doing it for a long time. And here I talked about the two bikes he's built most recently. One is based around an 8-litre, yes, an 8-litre V10 engine from a Dodge Viper. And the other one, the Flying Milliard, is his tribute to the board track racers of the Edwardian era. And is also, by the way, the biggest V-twin engine motorcycle in the world. Alan, I was the editor of one of the best-known custom motorbike magazines in this country. I've made three TV series about custom bike builders, but I've never met anyone like you.
Really?
And do you know why that is?
Why is that?
Because with everyone else, that I've ever written about or photographed their bike or made a TV show about how they've created this bike from nothing. The whole point of what they've done is to make something that looks like it was made in a shed. Whereas I think what you've done, do correct me if I'm wrong, is you've made things in a shed to look as though they've come out of the most sophisticated factory you could possibly imagine.
Well, that's what I've always aimed for. I always want my bikes to look like they're long-lost prototypes that could have happened.
The one that I remember seeing first, or the two that I remember seeing first, were the Kawasakis. Tell us about them.
Well, the Kawasakis, I started making five cylinders from the KH250s back in 96, 97. Basically, I just cut two engines in half and welded them back together again to make a five-cylinder, but in a similar way to the Kawasaki engineers did, because the triple was devised from the twin, and they basically added an extra cylinder on the left and moved the engine over in the frame. So I just added another two and moved it over a bit more. And I remember at Stafford in 97, I think it was, or 96, that some Japanese tourists were there, and they actually believed it was a Kawasaki prototype. So that was the best. That was the biggest accolade for me, having someone say it. They thought it was a prototype from Kawasaki. And that sort of stuck with me then. And after that, I was trying to make my bikes even more and more convincingly factory-like.
What were the special problems with the Kawasakis? Because you made an 850, didn't you? And you made a 1000cc. One was a four-cylinder, one was a five-cylinder. I mean, you make it sound as though you got some decals from the off Amazon or something like that. You put them on the bike in 10 minutes while you were having a cup of tea and listening to the radio. There are incredibly difficult engineering conundrums, mysteries to solve when you're trying to not just modify a motorcycle so radically, but as you've said, to make it look like it came out of the Kawasaki factory.
Yeah, the other thing as well, all my bikes have to work. I won't build a bike that doesn't work, that can't have a proper MOT or pass an SVA and be driven on the road and ride it to the Isle of Man and take it around a racetrack and come home without having to fiddle with it, you know. I like all my bikes to work. So the thing is attention to detail. You have to fully understand how the designers designed the bike in the first place before you can modify something. If you don't understand how something works or thoroughly understand it, it's very hard to modify and keep it reliable.
Now, let's talk about the two bikes that you're best known for now, and which I've seen you out and about on over the summer at the Pageants of Power and Salon Privé and all these kinds of very swanky events, if you don't mind me mentioning it, Alan, that you get invited to these days.
Yeah.
Firstly, the V10 engine motorcycle. Tell us about how that bike came about, Alan.
Well, it's a bit of a long story, but I'll try and do it quickly. But basically, Chrysler actually brought out a Tomahawk in 2003 or 4, I can't remember now, which is basically a biper engine motorcycle, but it had four wheels, so technically it was a car, I guess.
Obviously, when we say it had four wheels, Alan, they were very close together at the front, the two wheels, weren't they?
Back and front, yeah, they were like 6 inches to a foot apart.
But even though it had that V10 Dodge Viper engine, so that's the all-alloy version, that engine is a lot more popular as a truck engine. Does that have an iron block? And the sports
the truck,
car engine, yeah, the trucks have an iron block.
Basically, Chrysler sent the engine to Lamborghini in Italy back in '92, a bus engine that made 200 horsepower roughly, and said to them, "We need to make a sports car. Can you do some work on it and make it better?" So they sent it back all cast in aluminium and magnesium with 500 horsepower.
And I went to the launch of the Dodge Viper in Monaco, and yes, it was very nice, thank you. And a few years later, Chrysler themselves said, "Oh, we've got this bike called the Tomahawk."
That's correct.
And people like me and you, and it's got the Viper V10 engine. Mm. Eight litres, is it, Alan?
The only one's 8 litres, yeah.
So, but people like me and you looked at it and went, "Oh, that motorbike seems to have four wheels. That's not a motorbike."
That's right.
So you thought, "I know what I'll do. I'll build an actual Viper engine motorbike," and you did.
Well, there was lots of claims about its top speed being in excess of 400 miles an hour. Having done 200 on mine, I now know that is physically impossible. Well, I'll throw the gauntlet down to Chrysler to prove it, but I don't think they would be able to with the aerodynamics.
I don't think so.
That's beside the point. I wanted to make one that I had to be able to ride it, even though it weighs 600 kilos. I had to be able to ride it safely.
How much does that engine and gearbox weigh, Alan?
The engine and gearbox together is around about £700.
Good grief. And that's the all-alloy version. Think how much it'd weigh with the iron block. Blimey.
Unmanageable with a cast-iron engine.
So was the idea always to have the whole unit, the engine and the gearbox?
No, I didn't use the gearbox.
Don't need the gearbox.
It has like a differential bevel gear on the end of the crank behind the clutch.
I mean, it must be an absolute torque beast.
It's mental. It's £500 for a torque that comes in about 3,000 revs, which is around about 100 miles an hour.
So I was going to say it's technically the world's biggest twist and go.
Well, it could be, actually. Yeah, it could be. It's hard to explain to people. I was at that wheelie event with Straightliners at Elvington.
I should explain that I saw Alan at the World Wheelie event, which was held at York in England recently. This show goes out around the world, Alan. It was held at York, an old airfield, and a lot of old faces, including the Ghost Rider himself, Patrick Furstenoff from Sweden, and the most naturally talented stunt rider I have ever seen, Gary Rothwell, were all in attendance. And Alan, Zef Eisenberg, friend of the show, the guy who's been on the show before, he was there with his new V8. But Alan, you nearly stole the show, or really stole the show, with the V10 bike.
Yeah, the organiser said it was the biggest engine motorcycle I ever had at an event, which was quite cool. But I must admit, I disappointed them with my speed, because I chickened out about 185 miles an hour as I was approaching the timing mark. Because I got into a tiny little bit of a weave, although I was told afterwards it was nothing and I should have just powered through it. But I thought there's always another time.
Alan, there's always somebody there to tell you. I remember when I was learning to ride a speedway bike, there was a fellow there giving me advice at the side of the track. Oh, you want to go a bit faster, Steve, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Anyway, an hour later, when he was being put in the back of an ambulance, having broken his arm and dislocated his shoulder, I reminded him of his advice. There's always somebody to give you advice about how to go over 200 miles an hour.
That's
but
correct, yeah.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here, and it's something that I do, and I apologise. But did you have to buy a full car? Did you have to buy an entire Dodge Viper to get that engine?
No, I was really, really lucky, because my son... After we saw the Tomahawk at Goodwood on the television, my son was on eBay, and this was back in 2004 when it was in its infancy on the old dial-up, it takes forever, you know. And he shouted to me, Dad, there's a Viper engine on eBay. You need to buy it so you can make a Dodge Viper bike. And that was it. He's only 8. So, you know, I come running upstairs, I had a look at it, and sure enough, it was there. And it was like £5,500 with minutes to go, no bids. So I just clicked buy it now. And I thought, afterwards, I thought, what have I done? But anyway, I went and collected it, and it sat in my garage for a year, but I recuperated funds and stuff and decided what to do and started to think how to make the bike.
Was it complete with a gearbox as well?
No, it was just an engine and a clutch with all the ECU.
Well, that was perfect then, wasn't it?
It was, and it's an early one as well. It's 96 GTS 500 engine, so it's a good strong engine.
So... You looked at it for a year. It might have been 2 years, and then you thought...
I started making it in earnest in 2007. I had it up on bricks in my garage, and I used to sort of ponder and look at it and ponder. Mm. And look at it. Mm. But then it just one day it just went click, and I thought, right, this is what I've got to do. And I made subframes, a bolt on the back and the front of the engine, basically, to hold the forks and the rear wheel.
So the engine is a stress member. It's like an old BMW, yeah?
There's no frame. The tank sits on top. The forks bolt on the front and the rear swinging arm bolts on the back.
Is the tank? Well, there'll be pictures of the bikes on the Steve's Speed Shop Facebook page of all of Alan's bikes. I'll put pictures up there so everyone can see what they look like. They always look amazing. Your bikes, but the Viper engine one looks because you're not the biggest of men. Please don't take offence, Alan. You're in good shape, but you're not the biggest of guys. And on the Viper engine bike, it almost looks like a young boy sort of climbing on his dad's motorcycle when his dad's not looking and trying to reach the handlebars because it's such a physically ginormous motorcycle. Is the fuel tank modified from an existing one, or did it just have to be made from scratch?
I'll tell you what it is. It's actually part of a 1969 Kawasaki H1 fuel tank, basically. The two front... sides at the very front, I sliced out of that tank that I had laying around. It had a few dents in it, so I didn't mind cutting out. And the rest is made from sheet steel. Best like a patchwork blanket, all TIG welded together. And then when you got the rough shape, you turn it inside out and beat it onto the ground on a bit of some sand to get it to the right shape you want, and then weld the bottom on.
So what about the running gear at the front and back? I think you told us. Just tell us again how drive is transmitted to the rear wheel.
It's literally through a clutch with a neutral. and a direct drive to the rear wheel. I've got like a differential, like a rear differential worm and bevel gear that transmits the transmission through 90 degrees. And it's got a standard sprocket at the front and a standard sprocket at the back.
Alan, this is going to sound awful. It sounds in some ways like an agricultural power takeoff on a tractor.
It's exactly what it's like.
All right.
With a neutral. So I'm pulling away in effectively top gear. My gear ratio.
That's a 6-speed that Viper GTS, isn't it?
Normally, yeah. But the gear ratio that I ride it around in is 225 miles an hour at 6,000 revs.
Because I noticed that you don't drag race it, because presumably it's setting off in top.
It's hard.
So it's quarter mile. It's quarter mile times are terrible, I would imagine.
Well, wouldn't be brilliant, I don't think. Once it gets going past 50, nothing keeps with it. Honda Fireblades, R1 Yams, anything. On the road, if I'm going over 50, nothing will stay with it. And that's what's really fun. Off the line to 50, yeah, it's not brilliant. But then it weighs 600 kilos, and I'm pulling away in top.
What about things like the swinging arm at the back and the back wheel? What is that back wheel, Alan?
Well, I had the wheels made to my design by a company in Birmingham, Image Wheels.
Oh, I thought you were going to say PM made the wheels, but because PM make a lot of wheels like that, but there's Image Wheels in Birmingham. And how did you know those guys?
I just looked on the internet for manufacturers of split rim wheels. Originally, when I first built it, I had cast wheels, and they were not ideal. The front one was welded to width, and the width was reduced by welding it, which is not ideal.
Oh, dear.
So that did 207 miles an hour with that welded wheel. But anyway, that's another story. So that's gone, and now I've got proper, decent split rim aluminium wheels on it now.
And how difficult was it to source tyres? I would imagine with the sort of Orange County choppers, West Coast choppers type carry-on that's been going on in recent years, these sort of widths of tyre that you would require are actually available.
Yeah, the Avon makes some really cool stuff. The back one's a 280-20, which is I wanted to look right. I mean, I could have used a 17-inch standard motorcycle wheel. I had much more range of tyres, but it looked more like a scooter because it's so long. It's 9 feet long. So if you've got small wheels, it accentuates the length. So I wanted
9 feet long, Alan.
Yeah, 9 feet from front to back.
What about the back suspension? It looks like a sort of conventional sports bike monoshock, you know, where you'd expect to find a monoshock on a Fireblade or a Ducati.
That's
or something
correct,
like
that. Yeah. It's a single-sided swinging arm, but it's made out of 8mm thick carbon steel, honeycomb as well inside. And it's like 9 inches high and 4 inches wide, the beam section. But I've got twin Yamaha R1 shocks.
Right.
Running 900-pound car springs to
Oof.
Them.
How much of this fabrication would be done in the shed at the bottom of the Mill Yard Garden, Alan?
All of it. I didn't farm anything out whatsoever. The only thing I farmed out to specialists was obviously the making the wheels, painting the fuel tank and the chrome and the anodizing. That's the only thing I found. Everything else I did, all the hydraulics, the electrics, the welding, the aluminium welding, everything. I do it all myself.
We talked about the back end. What about the front end? I would imagine you were just looking for the sturdiest. You're not necessarily looking for the quickest turn in front end, are you? You're thinking...
Well, no.
Right,
well,
what?
No fork, there was no forks big enough to look right, so I had to make my own. They got 75mm stanchions on them.
So you made your own forks. So what are the springs like inside those forks? Where did
they're
you actually, get them from?
They're off a Vauxhall Colton car, believe it or not. sorry, I correct you. The dampers are out of a Vauxhall Colton front strut, and the springs I had specially made by Hagen, I believe. Hagen, yeah. Hagen Springs.
What about things like wheel spindle? Alan, what? I've been around a lot of custom bike builders, and I see that other people who haven't been lucky enough like me to spend that time in their workshops, they don't realise that so much time and so much effort and so much heartache goes into making things that no one notices, like the wheel spindles and stuff like that.
Yeah, but they're huge on my bike. They're 40mm diameter. The back's 60mm diameter and the front's 40mm diameter. You just get some chromolydium steel from the steel people and put it in your lathe, and a couple of hours later, it's all shiny and ready.
There you go. What your approach seems to be... make it strong and then make it even stronger and then have another think and make it even stronger again.
I always tend to over-engineer, especially on things that got 500 horsepower. Because what's an extra 100 pounds when it already weighs 1,200? It seems silly, really. So everything's beefed up.
So can you remember the first time you rode the bike? What was it like?
I can. I got the SVA approval on the 1st of August.
So we should explain what that is. SVA here in the UK is single vehicle type approval. If you build a scratch-built custom vehicle, whether it be a car or a motorcycle, you have to take it to a government test centre and they put it through some extensive testing to make sure that you haven't built a death trap.
Three white men with glasses for 2 hours. And they actually said to me when I went in there, it's very rare to pass first time, so don't get too excited.
Hey, everything I've taken's passed first time.
Yeah, passed first time. So this is the Southampton one.
Oh, you should come to Manchester. They're very understanding.
Oh, OK. So, yeah, I got my certificate through the post, got my number plate made and put it on the bike, and it sat in my garage for about a week before while I plucked up the courage to actually ride the thing.
Oh, wow. It's amazing that you're willing to admit that as well, Alan.
No, I don't mind admitting it, because it was just starting out scared the hell out of me when you first, this thing roars into life. And I basically pulled away from my house, and I couldn't go around corners, because there's quite a real technique to turn it at slow speed. You have to sort of lean it and commit. And once you're going around the corner, whatever corner you want to go around, you can't suddenly decide you're not going to go around it, because it doesn't like it.
No.
So I had to drive 10 miles to go around this big roundabout and then come back to my house. And that was the only loop I could do for the first couple of weeks. And then I eventually got better and better at it. And now I can fly around. I mean, I took it to the Isle of Man TT. I rode it on the ferry. I've been up down the M6 on it. I ride it everywhere now, and I think nothing of it. I can just jump on it and ride it.
I've ridden Boss Hosses three or four times. I've ridden an 8-litre one.
Yeah.
But the problem for me, Alan, was that on both those bikes, I was right over the blinking engine. And it kind of took a lot of the pleasure away from it, because every time I came to any kind of stop or slowed down, the thing was roasting me alive. Now, I've noticed that on your bike, you're sat back away from the engine. And I imagine that that's because you don't want to be flambéed.
That's correct. And obviously the manifolds get really hot. When I ride the Viper, you should wear leathers on a motorcycle anyway, but I tend not to most of the time. But when I ride the Viper, I always have leathers on, because not so much from abrasion for me, but the heat. You've only got to like glance the exhaust manifold with your leg with jeans on, and you burn yourself off your jeans, not off the exhaust, if you know what I mean. Your jeans get instantly red hot and they burn the skin. But apart from that, I mean... I've ridden it through London, through Chiswick, on the flyover on the M4 in rush hour traffic, and it's been fine, you know.
How do you get it on and off the stand, Alan? It weighs £1,200.
Side stand on both sides.
So side stand on both sides,
That's my safety thing, because when I pull up, I always put both side stands down, and if I lose my balance or someone knocks it, it's not going to fall over.
Very good.
And then the centre stand's got a little ratchet system that I carry, a little ratchet under the seat. It just pops on a little lever, and then you just ratchet it onto the centre stand.
And, of course, you made that.
I made all of that.
Of course you did.
It fails safe as well, because when it's on the centre stand, you can't push it off the stand. You have to ratchet it off the stand as well.
Right, so you built that bike, and for most people, that would be more than enough. However, most people aren't Alan Milliard. So I turn up, and then I can't remember where it was the first time I saw the flying Milliard. But it just stops people in their tracks, doesn't it? People are kind of, you can be at Goodwood, you can be at the Pageant of Power, you can be wherever, and there's all kinds of insanely multi-million pound value exotica. But when they see the flying Milliard, it stops them in their tracks. Tell us about this bike.
Well, firstly, one thing I will say is I did try to get into Goodwood, but they refused to return my emails.
Which
is very sad, really. If I would like to take it there, if I'm sure it'd go down well, but maybe next year, we'll see.
Maybe next year. I'll get you in. I've got a bit of sway down there. I'll get you in, Alan.
Anyway, I'm not bickering about it. It's probably a very nice show. But I would like to go there sometime with the bike, because I'm sure it'd be good.
So I'll describe what it looks like for people. It's like, imagine a kind of Great War era American board track racer motorcycle, a Thor, an Excelsior, a Flying Merkle, which I'm sure was in your mind when you named it.
Yeah.
Or even an Indian or a Harley Davidson, one of those bikes that those incredibly brave or stupid, probably both guys, brakeless motorcycles that they would race on the banked board tracks in the USA and cross it with a kind of something from the imagination of Tim Burton. And I think you've got some idea of what the Flying Milliard looks like. Where the hell did that giant engine... Tell us about that giant engine, Alan.
This is a little tiny story as well, because I was at Salon Privé in 2012, which is like a Concours d'Elegance in London, Sion House, and I had the world's smallest V-twin, which is a 99cc Honda V-twin I've made. Looks like a little 60s racer. And I won the biggest wow factor award at the show. And Steve Parrish said to me when he was giving me the award, he said, great, brilliant bike. He said, what are you going to do next year? So I sort of just glibly said, I'll make the biggest V-twin. And I didn't even think what I was going to do. I just thought I'd make a big V-twin.
So how big?
So as big as I could get cylinders from. So I came straight home, went on eBay, and I was looking for like car cylinders, or maybe Volkswagen car air-cooled car cylinders, so I could make like a 2-litre V-twin. But
yeah,
I straight up on eBay popped, it said aeroplane cylinders. And that's all it said. It said pair of old aeroplane cylinders. And it was being sold by the Vintage Motorcycle Club up in Birmingham, Allen House. So anyway, I won them. So I went up on the Honda Pan-European the next day to pick them up. And when I saw them, they looked four times as big as what I expected. They're six-inch diameter pistons with a six-inch stroke that displaces over 5,000 cc for the two cylinders. And I thought, oh, my God, you know.
5,000 each or 5,000 between 5, them?
5,000 for the two. And they stand, they're 18 inches long from the top to the bottom, the cylinders with the heads.
Do you have any idea? Have you? I would imagine you're a very thorough man and you'll have tried to find out what aircraft these cylinders came off. Have you had any luck?
No, not at all. No, I know now, but when I bought them, I didn't have a clue. They actually offer a Pratt & Whitney Wasp radial engine.
Right.
Which would be fitted to like a DC-3 Catalina flying boats. I believe some of the...
What vintage would that be, Alan? Between the wars or...
Yeah, it's probably 1945.
Yeah.
It's between 38, 39 and 45.
So they were just the cylinders, no pistons?
No, I had pistons as well.
Oh, you had the pistons. Marvellous.
Valves, piston rings, all the collets. The whole top end was complete, which is really, really good. Top down, I got little wooden boxes and spares as well. So they only just fit on my bike. So I was not expecting them to be so big. So I got them home and...
They just about fit on a Pan-European.
On the back in a wooden just, box.
Just
box
managed.
3 foot square by about 2 foot thick. So I strapped them straight on the seat and brought them home and... The first thing I did was take them up to my people do my cleaning for me, like not the laundrette, but the aluminium cleaning, and got them vapor blasted to sort of see what I could, you know, what I was working with, and they come up like absolutely like brand new. So I popped them straight on the dining room table on a big piece of paper and sort of just hand sketched out a crankcase and a crankshaft to see what sizes I was talking about, metal wise, you know, to order the metal, and the crank's a foot diameter, 12 inches diameter.
Wow.
Flywheel webs are 2 inches thick. The connecting rod. Crank pin is 80 mil diameter by 200 millimeters long.
There was never going to be an existing crank that you could use for this project, was there?
Every single component is scratch built on that engine.
The comrods, the crankshaft, the crankcase.
Yeah, crank, all the cams, the drive mechanism. I used Ford Fiesta cam chain and driving gears. Things like that you could buy for £20. What's the point of making it, you know? So I tried to make things fit. The oil pumps were off a Honda Fireblade.
What about a gearbox?
The gearbox, I was really lucky. I got it off a Morris 10, 1936 Morris 10.
A very nice, respectable family motor car.
It's all cast iron and brass, and it looks perfect. But the insides are out of a 1954 MGTA sports car, so it's got strong straight-cut gears.
What is it, three-speed?
It's four-speed.
Four-speed? Ooh.
Crash first and second, and reverse, of course. I have reverse.
Reverse, of course, reverse.
One had to have reverse on one.
So the Viper's 9 feet long. This thing's incredibly high. You can just about see over it. How long and heavy is this one?
Well, this one's about 8 feet long, but it's 4.5 feet high.
Yes, it
it's
is.
It's high. And it's the engine itself is 30 inches tall from the bottom of the sump to the top of the cylinders. So it's a very big bike. When you see the pictures of it, it's just like this massive engine. The wheels, believe it or not, are 21-inch diameter wheels, but they look like they're 17-inch wheels.
Are they for car? Are they car wheels? Or
no, they're actually Harley-Davidson front rims that I've spoked into my own hubs. Well, the front hub's off a Kawasaki triple and the back hub's handmade.
So, again, the engine is a stress member, but you've got a subframe front and rear to...
Yeah.
I mean, with an engine
well,
that...
It's semi-stressed. It's actually got a top loop because you can't bolt anything onto the aeroplane cylinders because they're not designed
for
anything to hang off them because they're very narrow, very thin.
Mm.
So you can't like put a frame connected to the cylinder. Everything comes off the crankcase, so the top loop goes over the top like a normal bike.
We didn't talk too much about the sound of the Viper bike. You have to hear it. It's amazing. But if anything, this bike, the Flying Merkel, sounds even more incredible, doesn't it?
Well, it ticks over at 350. And it revs to about 1,800. I don't take it much over 1,800.
It doesn't rev over 1,800. But with a 5,000cc V-twin, So you've easily made the biggest. What's the biggest stroker motor that they run in custom Harleys? About a 2.7 or a 3 litre, maybe?
Something like that. It's big. It's gargantuous. When you see the crankshaft, I'll send you some pictures of my crankshaft, mate.
Let me show you my crankshafts.
you need to see it. You can put it on your page. It's sitting on a motorcycle news, basically, and you can't see the motorcycle news.
Wow.
It's as big as the motorcycle news.
So what's it like to ride, Alan, this bad boy? It must be tricky. Massively top heavy because of those giant cylinders sticking so far in the air?
It's top heavy, but there's so much to do. You've got to advance your ignition yourself. You have to control the mixture while you're driving along. It's got hand shift gears, obviously. So when you're riding the bike along, you can't just change your cruising speed from 30 to 50 by turning the throttle. You've got to advance ignition. You've got to lean off the mixture a little bit, just to make sure they get it just right. Either you get flames out the back or black smoke, so you try and get it in the middle.
I'm surprised you even bother with a gearbox, especially a four-speed. The torque must be just unimaginable.
Well, I tend to pull away in second and put it straight into fourth, to be honest with you. But I wanted a gearbox. I could have used a belt, actually, going straight to the back wheel, like a really early board tracker.
Yeah.
But I thought, I want a nice gearbox with a reverse, because I'd love reverse on my Viper, but I just haven't got the space to put it without making the bike really long.
Why do you like reverse on motorcycles, Alan?
On the heavy ones, it's lovely. When I pull up at a bike meet, I back it into a parking space. Everyone just completely laughs. They can't believe what they're seeing. I'm getting quite good at doing it now. I can almost do it feet up for the sort of 5 or 6 feet. So I just pull up, stop, and just reverse into my spot. And it always goes down well.
So which do you prefer to ride? The flying Milliard or the Viper engine?
You can't ask me that question because they're all my bikes. I like riding all of my bikes. Whichever one I'm on that day is the best one, if you know what I mean. Because they've all got their own characters. I like whizzing around town on my little SS100, and the SS250 is ballistic. It's 110 miles an hour with a 2008 KX250 engine in a SS50 rolling frame, basically. The Viper's just amazing, especially going long distance. It's an amazing cruiser. I really want to go on a little tour next year. I want to even go over to France, Germany, whatever, down to the Alps or something, on the Viper.
Oh, I don't know about the Alps. Maybe across the USA would be a good tour, Alan.
It's okay in the corners. You'd be shocked. I can get around the bends. I went up Prescott Hill Climb on it. Not Prescott, Cholmondeley.
Yeah.
Sorry. It whips around the corners. It's quite amazing, actually. I can put it this way. On the Isle of Man, I went round Ramsey Hairpin. So I can get round Ramsey Hairpin.
Was it over Balaff Bridge? Was it all right there?
That obviously is a 30 limit, isn't it? So I was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But I did nearly 140 down Croncavoddy, and I was doing pretty much 140, 150 up Harewood Rise, just for a split belief. It's literally, you accelerate up to it, then slow down nice and gently for the corner. You can't take the corners at anything like the speeds.
And I believe that the aim is 250.
That won't happen, not with me on it anyway. But the bike would do it.
Well, why don't you let Rothwell or Ghost Rider?
He's desperate for a go, Gary, actually. He's desperate. But how do you tell a really mega experienced stunt rider that I might have to give him some lessons to ride my bike? You know?
Well, it's Gary Rothwell that we're talking about here, who recently won the World Wheelie Championship. After about 20 years in semi-retirement, he came back and blitzed the World Wheelie Championship 197.4 miles an hour for a kilometre with the front wheel in the air, which for a man of Gary's advancing years, he's no spring chicken anymore, Alan. He's not so far off our age. Was quite an achievement. So who knows, maybe one day someone will take that motorcycle to over 250 miles an hour unfaired, which would be an amazing achievement. But what's in the Milliard Shed /workshop/ Iron Man's Den right now? What's going to emerge from there to startle the world?
Well, I'm not actually sure at the moment. I'm in between a lot of projects. So I've been making a few thousand fours and things just out of bits I've got laying around.
But so these are 1,000 four-cylinder, two-stroke Kawasaki's?
Yeah, based on the Kawasaki HT.
Which sound like the end of the world is about to occur when these things fire up. Yeah, so are they commissioned? People have seen the other bikes and they've asked you to build them, or...?
Not really. I tend to sort of make things for me, and then if someone's offers me the right amount of money, I'll let them go. I tend not to like to do sort of commission work because it puts me under pressure to actually do it, and I've got to get it done by that. I build bikes, and then if I ride them around them at a show or bike meet, and someone offers me the right money, then they go, you know. But the 1,000 fours are such an amazing bike. I've been making them for like 15 years now. Well, since 1998.
Well, mate, I think you are a unique talent. Like I said, everybody else that I've come across in the custom bike world, no matter how gifted, has always been endeavouring to create something unique that looks as though it's a one-off, whereas you have always striven, even with the Flying Milliard, to make something that looks like it came out of a factory in either between the wars in the Edwardian era or the 1970s or sometime in the future. And I say more power to you, sir.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
Welcome back to Steve's Speed Shop with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Now, cast your minds back, would you, to 1970, when most men looked like they had a small domestic pet squatting on their head and trousers were viciously flared and invariably brown. However, there were some good things like the launch of not just a new car, but a new kind of car. It was called the Range Rover. It was made in Great Britain. And it combined the best qualities of a rugged, practical, go-anywhere farmer's four-wheel drive with the class, sophistication, high level of specification and high performance of an executive sedan. It was a good idea then, and it's a good idea now. And there's a new Range Rover, the Range Rover Sport SVR. It has a supercharged V8 engine producing 542 brake horsepower, 503 feet-pounds of torque. It can achieve its electronically limited top speed of 162 miles an hour in three of the eight speeds available in its automatic gearbox, although curiously not in eighth. But if you tick a couple of boxes on the option list, say you get the 22-inch wheels and the real carbon fibre interior detailing, as opposed to the faux carbon that's in the standard car, you can end up paying a six-figure sum. And I'm not talking US dollars or even euros. I'm talking 100,000 of Her Majesty's Imperial Pounds Sterling, which puts it in the same ballpark as two cars, its bitterest rivals indeed, from the fatherland, the Porsche Cayenne Turbo and the utterly bonkers Mercedes G63 AMG. So, to find out whether the Range Rover Sport SVR is rated or hated, I made the short trip over to the city of Leeds in Yorkshire, in the north of England, to meet Chris Hannam, who's just bought a Range Rover Sport SVR.
This is Fab Radio International.
In the looks department, do you know what it reminds me of from the outside?
What?
Iron Man's helmet.
Well, yeah.
You know that sort of, like, the same sort of shape and style, and the way the lights wrap around a very thin band, it's a bit like, looks a bit like Iron Man.
Well, now you mention it, I can see where you're coming from, but I've never seen a Range Rover as an Iron Man, but, you know, it's definitely a different type of vehicle for Range Rover to market, for sure.
It's... What about inside, Chris? It's always been a classy place to be. In my youth, I tooled around in the original HSE. Do you remember that? That's got to be 30 years ago. With the velour upholstery and air conditioning and such like. Yeah. But in its time, it was always the poshest place that you could be and tow a horse box. And is that still the case today? Or do you think that in terms of style and the interior fit and the accoutrements that are available to us as we sit inside this fantastic car? I don't know why I use that word. I don't know why that came to me. Perhaps you can tell me. But do you still think this is the classiest place to be and you can tow a horse box?
Oh, without question. I mean, you know, again, everybody... You know, the Porsche has a great interior.
Well, what about the AMG, the G-Wagon? I was in one a couple of weeks ago, and to be honest, it was a bit like...
Agricultural.
Agricultural? No, I was going to go to the exact opposite. It looked like the executive lounge at Dubai Airport. It was all a bit, let's just throw loads of money at this and taste be damned. You know what I mean? It was, whereas this interior, we've got a lot of, I doubt that it is actually carbon fibre.
It's not carbon.
Of course it's not carbon. It looks like carbon.
You can actually get a £1,500 genuine carbon fibre option for what you're looking at, but 90% of people who don't know carbon fibre think this is, it's like a carbon fibre replica, if you like, and it's free. You know, I would rather have the performance than pay £1,500.
But it's very, very classy in here. A lot of leather, a lot of brushed aluminium, whatever you want to call it. It has a very masculine aspect to it, doesn't it? That's the thing. The weirdest thing, Chris, for me, in terms of the style of the interior, is that the 63 AMG G-Wagon, the Mercedes, it's got, this is going to sound a bit weird because it's the G-Wagon's thought of as the ultimate sort of macho SUV. It's very feminine, the interior.
Well, I personally don't like Mercedes. I think the engines are the best in the world. You know, they're really, really good. But the rest of the car, you know, you might as well just get 50 grand and throw it in the bin. Because the,
well, 50 grand for the 63 AMG, I think you can double that and the rest, pal. You know, I mean, we're talking about six figures here. This is 100,000 of Her Majesty's Imperial Pound Sterling.
Yeah.
It is a great place to be. Let's talk about the seats.
Yeah. What do you want to know? The fit.
Well, you're not exactly the most compact man that that I've, you know, let's be honest, you're a big, big lad.
Yeah.
Even at your size, do you find these seats comfortable long distance?
To be honest, Steve,
because they're very sporty, aren't they?
They are, and one of the things, when I went down to the dealership, and I only went down to service my other car, and they had this sat in the showroom.
And was it this colour? Because this blue...
It was this colour,
What do we call it? It's like a cobalt blue, electric blue, isn't it?
I don't even know the name.
Do you know what, Chris?
I just says I want one of them.
If you've got your own island,
yeah,
like some people have,
yeah,
and you wander down onto the white sands of the beach on your private island, that's what colour the sea is, pal.
Well, it's the thing is, you can only get this blue in this car. It's not available on any other Range Rover. This is the
I thought this was a Jaguar colour. Is the F-Type? You can get the F-Type in this colour, I think.
Of the Land Rover brand, you can only buy this car with this colour at this moment
in
time.
It's a great colour.
You can get every other colour you want, but, you know, I believe that if you're going for the special edition, you get the colour that goes with the car. And it just happens to be, I've had grey, I've had black, I've had white, and this happens to be the best colour so far.
So, in terms of looks, interior and exterior, it's got the Porsche beat hands down, and the Mercedes.
Well, I believe so. In my opinion, the Porsche performance, an outright performance, does, you know, eclipse this car. But
well,
other than that...
which one are we comparing it to? Are we saying that its direct competitor is the Cayman Turbo or the Turbo S?
The Turbo S.
Yeah, but the Turbo S is quite a bit more expensive.
Yeah, it's 20 grand more.
Yeah, if you look at the prices, Chris, this is almost directly in competition in terms of brake horsepower. They're both about 520, 530, the Turbo and the Range Rover SVR. The Turbo S is another thing again, isn't it?
Yeah, well, obviously that's the upgrade, isn't it? But you pay 20 grand more for that.
Yeah.
So you get what you pay for, but I'm sure, I know there's people who have had Land Rover work on these cars and I've got figures of 650 horsepower, but obviously you do that, you lose your warranty. The Turbo S is obviously, you know, a 3-year warranted car with that kind of power. So,
look, the Cayenne Turbo, it's 512 brake horsepower, 553 feet-pounds of torque. The Range Rover SVR is, it's what, this one? 542 brake horsepower from its 5-litre supercharged V8. It's nice to have a supercharger, isn't it? It's a bit special. Turbos are a bit common, aren't they?
Well, to be fair, you can't hear this supercharger.
Oh, that's no good.
Well, normally
it should be sticking out the middle of the bonnet, shouldn't it?
Well, it should really, and you know, norm on the old supercharger
might frighten people at the country club, sucking a Jack Russell or two if you're not careful.
You know, I had many years ago, I had a Ford F-150 Lightning pickup, and the supercharger really whined on that. on this vehicle, it's so well soundproofed, you know, you can't hear it. It's obviously there, you can feel it, but the exhaust note is just that aggressive. You'd never hear the supercharger anyway because it's that loud when you open the when you put it in dynamic mode, which opens the race exhausts, and it's just absolutely outstanding. You know, it's the Mercedes is poetry of an engine note, but I think Jaguar Land Rover have done an awesome job with this to make it compete in that, you know, in that area.
Well, it gets 2 ton of luxury car up to 16 about 4.5 seconds, top speed of 160. I said there was an amazing stat about the 8-speed automatic gearbox. Again, I think that's because the Porsche has an 8-speed automatic. I don't know if they actually need 8-speed. You'll have your own theory on that. But 162 miles an hour top speed, but it'll get there in, I think, 4 of the 8 speeds that are available. I think 4th, 5th, 6th and 7th. It doesn't get to it in 8th. It won't do the absolute top speed. But if you can get to the top speed in 4 of the 8 speeds that are available, that's a lot of torque, isn't it?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, like I say, there's obviously a margin for, you know, Land Rover have built this car to give it 3 years warranty and reliability. I'm sure that this car could produce reliably 700 brake horsepower.
Good Lord.
And not damage anything, the powertrain.
Well, if somebody who's got a 1,000 brake horsepower motorbike, you should know. I mean, what size is the motor in your top fuel bike? 2 litre, is it?
Well, I've got two top fuel bikes, Steve. I've got one in America, one in England. The one in England is built in my workshops in Leeds, and it's a 2 litre, and it's supercharged.
You like a supercharger?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're used to superchargers, but obviously the fuel's where it comes from, and the one in the States is just injected, and that's 3.2 litre.
Well, the AMG, the G63, has got even more horsepower than either the Porsche or the Range Rover. But of course, as I think, was it Pirelli once said, power is nothing without control.
Well, yeah.
It might have been Nietzsche as well, the philosopher, but let's not get onto that. What's most remarkable about this car, I found when I drove it, is how it contains and controls that 542 brake horsepower. It's just effortless, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I went to an off-road race on Saturday, and I'd been out for some dinner with some friends of mine, off-road racers, and we just happened to be on this disused road, I happened to put it in launch mode and set off. And the words I can't repeat that they said, but it were akin to, bloody hell, that were fast. I've never seen a car squat and accelerate so fast in all my life, you know, for an SUV.
I'm not sure you can put me right on this. The Porsche, the turbo with the twin turbos, let's not forget.
Yep.
And it's got a V8, so you've got the twin turbo whoosh, the V8 burble. Is that a better sounding car because it sounds like a turbo, because it sounds like a V8? Or are we looking, perhaps, for a little bit more sophistication from a car like this?
Well, they are different. I don't think the Porsche has got the same note as this because, as you know, a supercharger is obviously force-fed in by a belt drive. Porsche's turbo are obviously driven by exhaust gases, so a lot of the grumble is taken out by the turbos, shall we say. So what you get with this is a lot like the G-Wagon, I think. You get the exhaust note, but you get the performance of the supercharger on the, you know, G-Wagon. It's just an aspirated engine. Which is obviously like the old Formula One cars, which everybody, you know, thinks sounds, you know, the dogs conquers. So this is a compromise. It works for me, you know. The Porsche is a good car. I don't think you can pull, you know, a bad point out of any of them, really.
Well, I think you can. I think the G63, the Mercedes, the G-Wagon, the big one, the really, really expensive one. I mean, you can add 25,000 to the cost of the Porsche or the Range Rover for the top of the range AMG G-Wagon. It hasn't got anything like the poise of the Porsche or the Range Rover. And of course, when we're talking about the sound of this thing, there's a little button in there. There's a little special button. So,
it's a loud button.
Yeah. Well, I've driven American cars from the 50s that had the same thing. It wasn't the same level of sophistication. I think it was just a flap and you had to yank on a cable inside the cabin. And it, for town driving, it would shut off the exhaust to a degree to stop it from, to literally stop it from frightening the horses. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But the fact that they would build something into the car, so that you can mute the exhaust.
Yeah.
I mean, it gives you some idea, doesn't it, Chris, of the level of sophistication that exists within that car. And I don't know about you, but I think Porsche have come late to the party. Land Rover have been doing this for... Well, let's not include Land Rover, because that was a military vehicle, an agricultural vehicle. Let's start with Spenking's original Range Rover. Brilliant example of new thinking in car design. Let's have a vehicle not just for the farmer, but for the bloke who owns all the land. You know, that he can put his dogs in, that he can throw his guns in, and that also isn't an embarrassment when he turns up at the country club or he turns up, you know, and parks it outside in the chairman's parking space. And that's where we've come. In half a century, we've arrived here with this car, the Range Rover SVR. And the others, Mercedes and Porsche, they just can't match that.
I would agree with that, definitely. I mean, if you're looking for prestige, everybody knows that the full-size Range Rover is the prestige mark. The other marks all do a good job, but unfortunately, you know, the Range Rover is where it's at.
It's the Rolex, isn't it? It's the Riva boat, it's the Rolex watch, it's the benchmark. It's the car by which all the others in its class are judged, because they invented the class.
That's correct. I believe so. And this SVR is obviously a dip into the Porsche's performance. I mean, they've done it, you know, I don't know why the original concept came about, because I've not researched it, but I know that it's taken the lap record around the Nürburgring. It's now the fastest SVR around the
Nürburgring. What's its time? Its time's 1840, isn't it, around the ring?
I don't know what the time is.
I was having a look. It's about 1840. So it's up there with an original NSX. Yeah. Can you believe that? That it'd live with an NSX?
It's
what
unbelievable,
a beautiful
really,
car that was. So well balanced, so well poised. You do have a fuel consumption figure for me, don't you? Go on.
Well,
because you bought this car and you sent me a message and said, I've just been out in the car and it's told me what it's been doing to the gallon.
Well,
go on.
This is it. I mean, I had it down to six miles per gallon. Yeah,
miles to the gallon.
You know,
a production car. That's outrageous.
But then, you know, driving it every day.
And this is England. Yeah. This is England. The amount of money that we have to pay for petrol in this country. You're driving around in a car that's doing six to the gallon.
Yeah, well, when you go to America, it's not $2 a gallon, is it? But, you know, we don't buy them for that. I bought this simply because it crosses the performance sports car advantage with the usability and tractability of a
Range Rover. Is it as quick as that Bentley? Because I think the Bentley...
It's faster. Because when I had my Continental in 2007...
That is an underrated performance car.
Yeah.
People look at that car, they think it's a car for ladies who lunch. That is a very, very quick car A to B.
I can't remember the exact time, but 4.6, 4.7 rings a bell to 60 in my... and that were a W12 2007 GT Mulliner. Now, obviously, you can go for the Super Sports, fully tricked out, which I believe is about 3.9 seconds to 60, but that's like a two-seater car.
It looks a bit Vegas for me, that car.
I think
that's one for the Middle Eastern gentleman.
They do say...
Not for lads like us from the north of England.
Well, you know, I have to say, I went to Belgium to buy the Top Fuel bike in my Bentley, and I set off on Friday tea time, drove down to a friend of mine's, picked him up, went out of Dover, drove up to up through Belgium, up to Amsterdam to look at the bike, and drove back in, and I was back for 1 o'clock Saturday night. And they do say a Bentley is the most comfortable way for two seats to travel around the world, and I have to concur with that. You know, the quality of the Bentleys is absolutely superb.
But what about four people?
Four people, you've no chance. Forget it.
I'm thinking that this might.
This would do four people. I don't think this would be the most luxurious car to travel in. It'd be far superior to the Bentley for four people. But as you know, the front seats are like a bucket type seat, and that's one of the things that made me buy it. They've built a bucket seat for a larger person, you know, because you don't
because Americans will buy it and Russians will buy it, and they're big.
So the thing is, you know, it is a firm seat, but it's a comfortable firm seat. You know, whereas if you get in something like the Audi's build, you know, you feel like you're being held in by two planks of wood in some of them, like the RS4s and stuff. So it's not an option, but then you're into the cars again, you know.
Well, it's not the most comfortable way for four people to travel all around the world. That's the Maserati that's the Maserati Quattroporte, but let's not go
there. I don't know. You've got the big Range Rover, 5 litre.
Yeah, but this is it, isn't it? You make a very good point, Chris, because those epic journeys that we sometimes have to do, you know, hundreds and hundreds of getting up for four figures in a day, sometimes four figures in a day. It's all very well being in something super quick, a Lambo or a Lotus or something like that, but you can't rack up those massive mileages at consistent high speed. And something like this, that's exactly what people will do with it, won't they? People in North America, people in Eastern Europe, in Russia, in the Middle East, they'll buy a car like this, and they will rack up monster mileage in it, and they will do it at very high speed indeed. And so this thing's got it all together, hasn't it? The Jaguar Land Rover have got to know. It's all very well building a fantastically quick car, and like you say, it could probably produce a lot more horsepower. What do you reckon? 700?
Easily
700. But then things start to break.
I don't think they would. I think they've given a 3-year warranty on this. I think, you know, if you drove it flat out every day at 700 horsepower, I think we might have a problem. But I think this, you know, this would be. There's usually 25-30% in a build, you know, for a manufacturer of extra, shall we say. So, you know, 650, you know, I think they'd do it easily.
Are you tempted to tweak this one? Or are you going to leave it as
no,
is?
No, I'm just going to leave it. You know, I mean, it's a road car. It's an A to B car with obviously a bit of squirt for me. I honestly got in it and thought it were very average on the performance, but that's because I race a drag bike that goes 0-60 in a second. So, you know,
and 0-100 in what? Go on, Chris.
1.4. So it's very hard to sort
you know,
of,
most people don't do that, Chris.
No.
The vast majority of people would think that this was very, very quick as it is.
You have to take it like for like, and you know, this car is too bloody fast for our roads, where the other road users are involved, because it accelerates at such a rate of knots. There's not many other vehicles, like you say, other than the Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Porsches and things like that, you know, and most people are over 55, 60 who drive those damn things anyway and don't want to drive them fast.
Go on Wikipedia and look at the list, the Nürburgring times. There's a full list on Wikipedia of Nürburgring times. And this car, the Range Rover SVR, sits in amongst some very exotic company. Very exotic company indeed.
Well,
and, as I think I've already said, it weighs 2.2 tonnes and it's got electrically assisted everything, fantastically powerful air conditioning, a great stereo. You will struggle to go that fast in such comfort and luxury.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, you're not sat at the side of the road waiting for Lamborghini assistants to pick you up. Because, you know, these things.
Oh, are you going to start saying that Lamborghini's set on fire randomly?
I didn't know they're set on fire.
Well, when Nick Coulton, who's a regular guest on the show, comes on, he normally manages to bring it round to Lamborghini's set on fire. However, since he started saying that on the show, I have noticed that Lamborghinis do sometimes set on fire.
Well, I didn't know they're set on fire. I mean, Nick's probably more, you know, he's more into all that sort of stuff.
Well, he likes the American stuff. And like you were saying, you've come from the F-150 Lightning. I drove quite a few miles in that car. That was a very quick machine, but I always felt that it was kind of a bit like being fired at the cannon on a battleship.
Yeah.
This is a very different sensation and experience of speed, isn't it?
Well, they were just an unrefined power lump in a pickup truck. That basically lit the tyres up at, you know, stupid speeds and handled very badly, really.
I was driving one of those in this part of the country, and I hit the brakes hard at the end of a long straight for a turn, and it just touched the front spoiler down and smashed it into 1,000 pieces. And when I took it back to the dealer and apologised profusely, he said, oh, they all do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I bought mine from America and shit.
Can you imagine if this did that? Can you imagine if that happened on this? You'd be straight back there, wouldn't you? Yeah, happened?
Yeah, well, they've obviously checked it. You know, I mean, you only have to look at the size of the wheels, the brakes, the calipers. You know, everything is big.
Everything is big. And more important than the 542 brake horsepower and the almost equivalent figure for feet-pounds of torque, the sophistication of that 8-speed transmission, limited as it is to 162 miles an hour, which is probably for the best for everyone. That's not the most impressive thing about this car. When I drove it, one of the things we were encouraged to do was send it up to 100 miles an hour and then hit the brakes as hard as was humanly possible and do that a few times, just to prove that these massive, massive rotors and huge calipers that they've squeezed in behind these wheels are just, I mean, I've never driven anything with any kind of off-road pretension that had anything like the braking, not just the braking performance, Chris, but the braking composure, the kind of sophistication that it just brought you to a halt, with the feeling that you just popped a parachute out the back, because that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, I'm still running this in to a certain extent. I've not caned it into the red, you know. I've obviously done some quick starts, and I've done some, you know, obviously I've bedded the brakes in, because obviously you want your tyres scrubbing and everything. You don't want to end up, you know, in a mess. But you can feel that in dynamic mode, everything stiffens up. There's no body roll, there's no tyre squeal. It just goes and stops, you know. And I haven't pushed it to the max, like I said, because it's, you know, it's only run a couple of hundred miles, so you've got to break these things in. But
do you remember when these things used to stand on their nose?
Yeah.
Well, like a horse, like pulling up a racehorse. The thing would literally try and stand on its nose. That's a long time ago. Those days are gone. Whether you're buying the Mercedes, whether you're buying the Porsche, or whether you're buying this new Range Rover. So I think we've decided that in terms of looks, it's a better looking car than either the Porsche or Mercedes, both exterior and interior. It's just a classy place to be. It's incredibly. It manages to sort of project sports car aggression with luxury car sophistication and still look like a Range Rover. I think in terms of performance, Cor, how fast is it, mister? Well, as you said, it's probably too fast. But here's the thing. We often see a car or a motorcycle and we think, look at that, it's fabulous. How fast is it? Great. Then we hear how much it is. And all of a sudden, our opinion alters somewhat. This car starts at 93,000. This one's probably more like, specced up with the wheels and some of the extras you've talked about.
Yeah.
More like six figures, more like 100,000. It compares very favourably to the Porsche Turbo, Cayenne Turbo. The Mercedes is quite a bit more, the 63 AMG. I mean, a lot of people will be thinking, are you honestly going to say the words value for money for a 4x4, if you will, that costs six figures, £100,000, but you've bought one? Do you think it's value for money?
I definitely think it's value for money, Steve, because the equivalent Porsche, as you put it, for the same level of spec, was £6,000 more.
Now, well, the SVR's got a high standard spec, isn't it? It starts at 93,000, but you get a lot of standard. The Porsche Cayenne Turbo, you buy the standard one.
Yeah. There's nothing on them.
Yeah. You know. I'm not sure if they give you sun visors.
You might have to pay extra for that. I think you're lucky if you get a steering wheel from Porsche. But you know, the other thing we need to remember as well, Steve, you know, you buy an £106,000 Porsche that you may get a few grand discount on. You drive it out of the showroom and the Porsche and the G-Wagon, you're losing 20, 30 grand straight away. I've drove my car out of the showroom and somebody's offered me £5,500 to stop driving it. You know.
Wow.
So, you know, obviously it's a new car, it's on a wait list, but you still have to order a Porsche. They're still on a wait list. You know, this one's marginally longer. You know, it's six to eight months. A Porsche is 3 to 5 months. But you're getting a different product, and Land Rover, over the last 2 or 3 years, have held their values better than any other 4x4 that I'm aware of.
Right.
So,
well, I think that's, you know, it almost seems redundant to ask you, Chris Hannam, the Range Rover SVR, is it rated or is it hated? I've got a funny feeling I already know the answer.
It's rated.
It's rated, isn't it?
Definitely.
It's absolutely rated. Thanks, Chris.
Well, that's just about it for another episode of Steve's Speed Shop, brought to you in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Don't forget to tell your friends they can podcast the show either at Podomatic or iTunes, and you can catch up with old episodes on YouTube. See you all back here on Fab Radio International next Wednesday at 7 o'clock UK time.